This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Lake County Assessor Jerome Prince was what the Times called an upset winner over eight other candidates in yesterday's Democratic primary election, including incumbent Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson. We had a chance to talk with Mr. Prince this morning. Mr. Prince, thanks for joining us today. And first, your reaction to the victory last night.
Well, we're pretty happy and still very excited. And definitely excited for the possibilities that exist for the citizens of Gary.
Mm-hmm. When you had your conversation with Mayor Freeman Wilson when she did the concession call last evening, did she say anything in particular to you, or was it just a very brief call?
It was a pretty brief call. Mm-hmm. She extended congratulations, obviously, after her concession, and that was largely it.
Mm-hmm. Any thoughts that you have on how the campaign went or for the primary election and I guess what goals that you felt that you not only put out there to the public, which of course were your campaign planks, but also goals that maybe that you had for the campaign that you've been able to accomplish up to this point?
Well, sure. From a campaign perspective, you know, initially the primary goal was to make the citizens of Gary aware that we were running. As you know, there wasn't a very long period, or you may not know, that there wasn't an extended period at which we had publicly expressed consideration for the office. And to that extent, we had to develop a message and one that would resonate, that is, and you know, get that message out to the constituency within a 13-week period.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, from a goal perspective, I believe we've hit the mark there, obviously. And just from a future perspective, really eager to get to work to address some of the issues or concerns, areas of concern that were expressed to me during the campaign, and certainly some that I, you know, had in mind from the beginning also.
Obviously that you had your own thoughts about what needed to be done in the city of Gary, and you had apparently a lot of contacts with residents, people that joined the campaign as supporters, and so they certainly made their thoughts known too, I would imagine. Were there any other opportunities that you had to hear from other people, maybe from business people, from other sides, so to speak, within the city of Gary, to talk about the things that bothered them and that they wanted to see taken care of if you were elected?
Well, sure, Chris, and that certainly speaks to my initial response to your question as to how I feel.
Yeah.
I expressed excitement for not only myself and my family, but for the residents of Gary, and that would extend to people outside of the city. There was a recurring theme that certainly resonated as we campaigned, and that was is that people were desirous of some sort of change, and to that extent, I'm just really happy that they saw us as that change agent, and now it's my responsibility to deliver to the best of my ability a fresh approach to government, and that within itself is slightly or largely consistent with the message that we articulated over the last 12 weeks.
Had you had a chance up to this point here before the election itself to talk with other folks that maybe either were or are members of the city staff, so to speak, their employees of City of Gary, that they may have offered their concerns to you to at least let you know how they felt, and not expecting any of Mayor Freeman Wilson's administration unless they decide they want to help out in the election, but they've voiced their concerns to let you know too what they're concerned about.
There were occasions where we interacted with city employees, but Chris, you know, just respectfully so, I, you know, respected the fact that those persons were still employees of the city, and to that extent I trusted that they would exercise their will at the ballot box, and if I would, you know, just take a guess, I would imagine that some of them did support, or at least do support, my candidacy, and to the extent are willing and looking forward to working with the new administration.
Now, at this point, as we get past the primary election now, looking ahead to a November general election, you just mentioned in the comments that that you're going to pretty much follow the same path. Are there any other things that you might like to do differently to spend time during the rest of the campaign going up to the November elections to talk about, or things that you'd like to accomplish? If there's anything in particular different that you want to add on to what you've been doing so far?
Well, sure. This entire 13-week period has been an evolution of ideas and thoughts and, you know, all as a result of conversations and interactions with people in and outside of the city. And so to that extent, I'm certain that as we approach November and even January 1st, we will develop other ideas and just add on to the central theme of first we have to get an accurate accounting or understanding of where our revenues are. Yeah, and, you know, from there, I believe you sort of build out, you incorporate larger ideas relative to economic development and public safety. But in order to do anything, we must know exactly where we stand financially as a city. And to that extent, that's going to absolutely be the primary goal.
Now, do you have any thoughts, not that you're going to have probably any insight from the opposition, but any thoughts as to who there might possibly be as an opponent in the November election? We know the Republicans haven't fielded anybody, at least in the their campaign, up to this point for their party's primary election. Will they likely, do you think, might have somebody that will be up against you in November?
Well, it's always a possibility, just as a part of the process. And to that extent, we respect the process and will be prepared to at meet any challenge, you know, that exists. But technically speaking, or just from a historical perspective, I don't remember the last time there's been a Republican opposition in the fall, particularly when there isn't one in the primary. Although I believe there's some state law that allows a Republican to still field a candidate all the way up until either late June or early July, and so that very well may happen. Something that's also a consideration as an independent candidate, and to that extent, that may happen, and if so, we'll address that challenge when it presents itself.
Yeah, so it may be somebody that has run in this primary election that wasn't successful, may decide to run as an independent, and you'd face that person in November.
Well, actually, I don't think that that's permissible. I believe that if you're a candidate in the primary, you're prohibited from mounting an independent run in the fall. So that would exclude any candidate who ran in the primary, for sure.
Well, thank you very much for spending time, Mr. Prince, to talk about the success that you had at the primary election, being the candidate for mayor for the Democratic Party for the city of Gary, and the best of luck for you for the campaign. Hope to have a chance to talk with you again during the campaign for the rest of the summer months into the fall, and certainly coming up to the November election. Thank you for spending time with us today.
I welcome the opportunity, and thank you for having me today, Chris. Thank you.
Early this spring, parts of the Midwest were flooded and seeing record floods, actually. And with the climate change, Indiana's winters and springs are only going to get wetter. The Purdue University Climate Change Research Center says that by the middle of the century, Indiana could see up to 20% more rain in the seasons, likely leading to more flooding. But as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel tells us, like many people living in Midwestern states, few Hoosiers have flood insurance.
Deb Guffey has had enough. She and her husband, Ray, own Brown County Tire and Auto Service in Nashville. This February marked the third time their shop has flooded in the past 10 years. Outside, employees tried to lift a customer's car out of the water and onto a tow truck. Inside, Guffey says the water in her office was more than 4 feet deep.
It came so fast. We tried to unplug what we could, and my secretary and I, Jessica, got shocked. And so finally, she just grabbed my arm. She said, "We got to get out of here."
Now the Guffeys are moving the shop to the south side of town to hopefully escape the flooding.
It's either that or close up.
The Guffey shop sits just inside the floodplain, but right now they don't carry insurance. Most homeowners' insurance policies don't cover flood, so you have to purchase it through the federal government. As of 2 years ago, a little more than 23,000 properties in Indiana were covered under the National Flood Insurance Program. That's less than 1% of households and businesses in the state. James Sink is an insurance liaison for the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA. On a Skype call, he says historically about 20% of flood damage claims would come from outside the floodplain. But that percentage is growing as rain patterns change.
So just because someone doesn't live inside of that special flood hazard area does not mean that they're not at risk for flooding. Low risk does not mean no risk.
So how do people find out if they should buy flood insurance? One way is to look at federal floodplain maps. Unfortunately, those maps are often out of date, especially with the changing climate. David Knipe with the Indiana Department of Natural Resources helps create Indiana floodplain maps for FEMA. He says FEMA is supposed to update its maps every 5 years, but Congress has to approve the funding to do it, so it ends up being more like every 5 to 10. Even if floodplain maps were more current, he says they're only meant to show risks from rivers and streams.
However, there's also risks that aren't mapped with these maps, more localized flooding that you'd see like in a neighborhood if you had a large downpour over a neighborhood.
And Knipe says we're seeing that kind of flooding more often. Take, for example, two neighborhoods outside Columbus. Amanda Burdine and her neighbors in Armouth Acres and Northcliff suspect drainage tiles from nearby farm fields are sending water into their homes and yards during heavy rains. This spring, Burdine's home had standing water for more than 30 days.
You have no ability to take showers, wash your clothes, go to the restroom. There were people that had to be taken out of the neighborhood in trucks by family members and didn't come back for 2 or 3 weeks.
After the last flood in 2015, Burdine fixed the damage to her basement, where her two oldest daughters sleep, and bought two pumps to try to keep the water down. It totaled $25,000.
So in January, we paid off that debt, and we got flooded again in February.
Most Hoosiers qualify for flood insurance, even if they're not in a floodplain. But not everyone can afford it. James Sink with FEMA says the average premium in Indiana is just over $1,000 a year. That's about the same amount the average Hoosier pays for home insurance. Most people who own a home in an area that floods would want both. This leaves residents like Amanda Burdine feeling stuck.
We just don't know what to do next because we don't know what's going to happen the next time it rains. Do you fix it and cross your fingers? Or do you not fix it and prepare for what will happen again?
David Knipe with the DNR says the agency is working with FEMA to find ways to more quickly update floodplain maps. Until then, residents will have to decide if the peace of mind that comes with flood insurance is worth the cost. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
Governor Eric Holcomb signed a bill into law this week that'll help fund adult high school diploma programs that are based on performance and not just enrollment. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Justin Hicks tells us that the requirements will affect programs across the Hoosier State.
The new law establishes the Workforce Diploma Reimbursement Fund. It lets programs that award adult high school diplomas apply for a reimbursement of up to $6,750 per graduate. To be reimbursed, the programs must also maintain a graduation rate of at least 50%, among other requirements. Indiana Republican Senator Jeff Rotz authored the bill.
And the best part about it is that there's no payment up front. When the students earn credits, that's when the organization is paid.
The governor's workforce cabinet must approve every diploma-awarding organization prior to reimbursement. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Justin Hicks.
And the newly signed law will help provide more structure for opioid treatment providers. And Jill Sheridan tells us that the move is going to make sure that Hoosiers who need the medication-assisted treatment are getting some comprehensive care.
Methadone is highly regulated in Indiana, but providers who prescribe another medication called Suboxone or buprenorphine haven't been held to the same standards. Republican Senator Aaron Houchin says some of the state's office-based opioid treatment or OBOT facilities need more regulation.
Rather than just prescribing Suboxone for people to take and walk away with without actually treating the root cause of the substance abuse addiction.
The number of OBOTs has grown to more than 600 in recent years. The new law will require providers to include counseling, drug screening, and prescription monitoring, as well as medication-assisted treatment. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
My parents gave me the confidence in myself, even before being a pilot. My parents, when we used to travel in the summer, and when we had like our summer trip, My dad used to give me the authority to lead them, to put this inside me, just like, you're a leader, you're a leader. I think my power, the power I got, like, I got it from the people I love, for my family, for my brother, for my nieces, nephew. I couldn't be weak in front of them at all. Sometimes I cry a lot, but most of the time I try not to show it that much because I want to give them this energy of being strong and being fighter and be a successful people in the society. It took me so much time to approve myself. Ages, like I sacrificed a lot of things in my life just to approve that I'm capable. This is the most costly thing I had to pay to be in this position in my journey. I had to pay this, not to have a family, not to have a normal life. I knew it from the beginning. I want it. But when you get older, things is changing in your mind. Just like, okay, now time is to have children. Now time is to have fully established in your social or emotional life. And that what is missing right now. When I first started, they told me, like, you would never find a Saudi man who accept your situation or accept your work. I said, like, no, I will find one day. I'm not going to give up on this. I will find the Saudi man who's accepting my position, my situation, and he will be supportive. My last training was with a female instructor, and she's a pilot she's a captain in Delta Airline. She's a female, and she has a family. She has daughters, and her life was normal. She used, like, she's instructing, and she flies. She doesn't have to worry about being a female at all. Sooner or later, the woman has to get their right to do whatever they able to do, if they want. I'm not asking her to go outside and work and get involved in other things rather than what she's doing, because her choice to be with her children, with her husband at house. But I'm saying for the women who wants to do something in their life, do work, what the reason why we're not allowed to. Because we are women like any other women around the world. We don't have disability, but the opposite. We have this spirit of challenging because we're forced for a period of time not to doing many things. Now we have this spirit of, we have to do it. We have to prove that we're able to do it. I could see it for many Saudi females that we cannot be abandoned for the rest of our life. We have to do something. And now we have a voice. We can talk and we can say it loud and clear. I'm so loyal to Saudi Arabia, very much. A lot of things in my mind, I'm just like, I want to do it for Saudi Arabia because I love this country. It's my country. This is where I was born, where I was raised. So when I hear some girl saying, thank you very much, you inspired me that everything is possible. It's not about only being a pilot, but you've done something, it was not permitted to do it in the country, but you did it. This is what makes you feel like, okay, I'm able to do more and fight more.
You can find more regional stories online at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. The Indiana, Lincoln County, Indiana Economic Alliance is working with the City of East Chicago to bring in some proposals from companies to transform the abandoned West Calumet housing project into a useful commercial or light industrial property. The LCEA's President and CEO Karen Lauerman was on Regionally Speaking to talk about this project and some others that they have taken on behalf of the City of East Chicago recently. Have you kept pretty busy in that city over the last few years?
Yes, we have. In the North Sector, we've been seeing a greater amount of repurpose and reuse of the aged industrial facilities. But in this particular case, we have been looking at a lot of brownfield remediation across the North Sector. There are smaller brownfield parcels in other areas of the county, but we know that the brownfield remediation is critical to redevelopment and new opportunities. And part of that brownfield remediation has assisted us in having the governor and then the U.S. Department of Treasury identify identify certain parcels or census tracts for redevelopment through the Opportunity Zone program, which is a federal tax program under the current administration for investment of large scale.
Now, for those people who are not necessarily familiar with the term, what is the definition of brownfields?
Brownfield is a contaminated site, according to the EPA. It could be anything like a gas station that's been vacated. That could be considered a brownfield in certain respects. But we're looking at these larger industrial sites that had water, soil contamination, things of that nature.
Did you get involved with Mayor Anthony Copeland and the rest of the city of East Chicago, not only because of the past projects that you have worked on with the city of East Chicago, but in particular with the problems that he is dealing with there with what used to be the housing project that is on, unfortunately, lead-contaminated soil?
Right. We've been working with the mayor since I would say 2000, I can tell you exact date, September 22nd, 2014. That's the day that my partner, Don Kolobowski, and I started at LCEA. We were the first staff members of that organization. And one of the efforts was to engage each community and each municipal administration. And we went out and visited with Mayor Copeland and his team and then started looking at the opportunities for reuse and repurpose of the aged industrial facilities, but not only that, where is there development opportunities? Part of our role and responsibility is to identify those buildings and the land space for end users, the companies mm-hmm. that will create the jobs and put the investment in. And our job is to attract that private investment. So in looking at East Chicago, there's a very large piece of property on Kennedy Avenue that has been remediated to about 80% and will be remediated completely with the advent of some other development in that particular sector. And then with the neighborhood that you're mentioning, our job is to ask the question, what happens next? And if it's part of the mayor's plan, that's wonderful. That's the idea, to have a cohesive approach to development in any community and throughout the county. With the West Calumet neighborhood, Zone 1 as we call it, what happens if the mayor's desire and the residents' desire goes off track? They want residential, and we respect that, and we work very closely with them on that opportunity. But what happens next? What happens if that doesn't come to fruition? Mm-hmm. We have to have a backup plan. And part of our thought process was to take all of the interest we were receiving because of the Opportunity Zone designation. That, again, that's that federal tax break program for the investment programs. Take those areas and take a look at what can be done. And we've got a lot of interest from those developers. So the prudent thing to do is say, hey, what would you guys propose on that site? If you've got an idea, share it with us. And we'll be happy to then share it with the mayor and his team. But we're not the decision makers. We're simply carrying a conceptual message, an option, so to speak, to the city. And if something is of interest to them and they'd like to pursue and proceed, we'll help them through that process. And if not, then they're going to go about making that residential opportunity come to pass.
So what you are working with, putting it out, I guess, from the city of East mm-hmm. Chicago standpoint, is not really a request for proposals, although it's kind of like that. Mm-hmm. You're just trying to get an idea from what companies are out there, mm-hmm. Non-profit businesses and the like, corporations and the mm-hmm. like, that might be interested in and maybe specialize in this type of work, to take this particular area, in particular with the West Calumet Housing mm-hmm. District area, and find some useful uses for it, I guess,
right,
at some point after the contamination gets cleaned up.
Correct. And what we're looking for are developers that can do both. And, you know, in the long run, the idea is, regardless of whatever status it becomes, what is the ultimate reuse? This thought process and RFP, you know, we wanted to make sure they were qualified developers. And these developers have experience in both remediation and actual business park or logistics or light manufacturing developments. These are the types of industry clusters that we want to attract to those sites, because there's no advantage to putting any sort of heavy industrial. You know, we're not going to put a chemical blender on that particular piece of property.
Right.
That's not resuited. You're not going to put a type of company that just came off of that site back into use on that site. The idea is to remediate, improve, and enhance.
I understand that you have several, three or four companies that have offered up some ideas. Mm-hmm. We know that there are certain things, non-disclosure agreements and things like that, that you have to abide by to get them to participate.
Right.
Can you generally say that these companies, maybe they're based on the East Coast or maybe here in the Midwest or elsewhere, since they have this experience that you're looking for, mm-hmm. in not only remediation of the problem soil in this case, but also developing the site once it's cleaned up?
Yes. The four companies that we've been working with have national and international experience in this.
Mm-hmm.
The majority of them all of them have development arms and environmental arms. It's environmental arm that will be able to do the remediation work and the development arm that has the contacts and the relationships with companies that want to locate close to the Illinois border.
Karen Lauerman says they hope to be able to turn over the prospective firm's proposals very soon to Anthony Copeland's office and for his staff and he to be able to review and to choose the process that begins. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Gemini's Head Start recently opened a new addition to its St. Mark Early Learning Academy in Gary, which Regional Health System CEO Bob Crumweed says is a major accomplishment in providing more families and more children in the city of Gary. And he was on Regionally Speaking to talk about the organization itself and about this particular expansion.
It was formed in 1993 as a joint effort between South Lake Center for Mental Health and Tri-City Mental Health Center in East Chicago. We found a need to kind of try to curtail some of our administrative costs. And so together we put together Gemini's to do all of our backroom stuff, human resources, our IT services, our electronic health record. And then in 1997, we had an opportunity to bid on the Head Start program, and we did that. And much to our surprise and pleasure, we were the successful bidder. And so we ran the Head Start program in Lake and Porter County and Stark County for the last 11 years. And so that's what got us kind of in the door in terms of early childhood education.
Where did Lake County finally fit into this now, since you mentioned you had these other activities that were part of Gemini's, and you've got involved with Head Start because of the contract that you were able to pick up outside of Lake County? Did you find that the success that you all had with the programs for Head Start in those other counties kind of lead into Lake County?
Well, we picked them all up at the same time.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I may have misspoke there, but yes, we picked all three counties up at the same time.
When people think of Head Start, is there anything in particular that they and then maybe it's, you find this out too, when you get people that decide to come in and they need the extra help, they have young family members that need to get a good start in their education, and we're talking about almost toddlers, I suppose, right, and the age?
Actually, with Head Start, we start with kids as early as 2 years old, but
wow.
For the vast majority of them are 4 and 5 year olds, and like every 4 and 5 year old, there's a need for early exposure to learning and educational stimulus. If they don't get that appropriately and in frequent enough volume, then they really suffer when they start school and they have to catch up. What we find is the kids that go through Head Start actually start ahead of all the other kids that go into kindergarten, and they maintain that lead up to about third grade, which is wonderful. So we're taking kids that need that additional stimulus, giving it to them early on, and they not only perform even with the other kids that came perhaps from higher income areas with two parent as opposed to one parent families, things of that nature, but they exceed in their performance in early education.
Is there something about Head Start that gives the youngsters the advantage that they get when they do go into pre-K or go into kindergarten?
It's just the attention that the teachers give them, and our teachers all have some advanced education preparation. Mm-hmm. But in addition to that, we bring the parents along with us, and so most of these parents want to do right, not most of them, all these parents want to do right by their children. And so we show them ways to stimulate them at home, too, in terms of wanting to learn. And it works out great for everybody.
Now, part of the Gemini's Head Start program is what is, formerly known as the St. Mark Center, which is based in Gary. Tell us a little bit about the center, because it's this we're talking today about the expansion, which is really major. But how did the St. Mark program get started there?
Well, we've been looking for a good site to expand our services in the Civil City of Gary. We've always had a classroom in St. Mark's Church there, and when the church when it became apparent that the church was probably going to vacate that site, we made an inquiry to them as to would we be able maybe to acquire the building that's right across the street from the chapel there, and fortunately they were quite eager to part ways with it and help us because we had the same kind of mission. And so we bought it. We did a pretty respectable renovation in addition to it, and we're now serving kids out of there full time. And it allowed us to increase our census by about 200 kids this year.
Wow! So you have about 200 more than what you had before. How many
all total?
How many were in the other? Just the single facility.
Well, I could tell you for sure how many were in the single. I know we had one class was about 26 kids probably. I think the building we have there now probably has about 100 kids in it. Mm-hmm. We treat 1,500 kids system-wide.
Now tell us, with all of this expansion, and you have this extra room and you're taking the best advantage of it, what are you offering now for the young people that come in there at St. Mark's?
Well, again, we give them a structured curriculum. Help them do things like learn their numbers, basic things like how to put their own shoes on, how to behave in a civil way with their classmates. It's a disciplinary issue that gives them all the tricks and talents and patience that a kid needs when they go into kindergarten. It works quite well.
Do they have the advantage now, I guess, when the weather's nice, to get out and do more things where maybe that they might not have had before?
Absolutely, and all of our sites have an outdoor playground.
Right.
So that works really well, too.
What do the youngsters that get involved in the program think, and maybe more importantly, what do their parents think about the early childhood education they get? The young people are probably just enjoying what's happening in the classroom, but and the parents are more concerned about what kind of impact it's going to have on their youngsters in the future, I imagine.
Well, yeah, but both of them enjoy the fact that the kids picking up the tools they're going to need for further education, and it's infectious. I mean, if you go in there and you watch these kids, it makes your whole day, and it does their parents too. They enjoy seeing their kids interact with other kids in an appropriate manner, and for a lot of kids, this is the only opportunity they have to have social interactions with children their own age. It's hard these days. Almost everybody has to work at least two jobs if you're a single parent, or both of you have to work if you're not, at a minimum. So it's difficult to give your kid that kind of socialization on the few hours you have available in between. And this provides it.
We're talking with Bob Crumweed, who is the CEO of Regional Health Systems. We're talking here first about the expansion of the St. Mark's facility, Geminis Head Start in Gary. And they have double the space now, I guess, as you had to work with before, I imagine.
It's probably four times the space.
Even much bigger than that, too. We've talked here just briefly about the overall regional health system here in Lake County and Porter and LaPorte counties. What does the rest of the services that the organization offer that has allowed for this expansion in particular? People maybe drive by a facility and they don't even see one, especially if they're looking at the facility that's located in here in Maryville.
Yeah, we've got a plethora of locations. We provide a wide range of services too. At Geminis, we obviously our early childhood education is home there. And in addition to working with the Head Start program, we also work with other child care providers in the area for them to increase their and improve their curriculum in terms of the way they treat the kids that are in their care. And the state actually provides them with some additional money through our child care vouchers that we also are responsible for doling out. If that child care provider brings on extra staff and works at improving their curriculum, they get a few extra dollars per year to treat the kids in their care. And so it's a four-level system. So if you go to a child care provider, you want to look for somebody that's at a three or a four level. Mm-hmm. And that means that they're paying attention and they have a good curriculum for the kids that they're treating. And we actually provide them with supervision around that.
Do you find that your organization is offering a lot more assistance to the, not only locally, but to the state of Indiana? They like to expand and make sure that their services that they have are the best, and you're kind of augmenting them, or you're certainly helping them out in their programs?
To some degree, that's true, yes. Yeah. And in fact, we've got a grant in right now to maybe provide some consultation to sites and services outside of the area that we serve right now, but that won't ripen for another month or two.
We focus here, I guess, mainly on the Department of Child Services. And in fact, we've just had our conversation with Tammy Silverman with IYI about that. Do you find that through your organization that you're helping not only deal with the issues of child abuse and neglect as well as early childhood education?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, you know, part of the regional health system family is Regional Mental Health Center, which is the combination of Tri-City and Southlake. And we do a lot of work with DCS there for mm-hmm. kids that have been referred to us for a variety of problems. You know, sometimes it's just truancy. Other times there's abuse and neglect. Sometimes there's a terrible behavior problem. And we help with a therapy that puts those kids, keeps those kids in the community and helps get them back on the right track. And we do a lot of work just with parents and children where there's a lot of, you know, conflict in terms of the relationship there. So that works out really well for us also.
So obviously, Child Abuse Prevention Month is certainly an important month for you all, as well as it is for IYI and even DCS, I imagine.
Absolutely. And before I forget, we're going to have a candlelight vigil tonight on the square in Crown Point to remember victims of domestic violence, especially kids. And it's always pretty well attended. It's kind of neat.
And we kind of focused here on the DCS, because that's one of the agencies within the state government that deals with these issues. But the overall umbrella of the Family and Social Services Administration comes into play here, too. And I imagine you probably have a role that you have with the overall FSSA, don't you?
Absolutely. Actually, the mental health side of the shop for us is clearly the largest. Mm-hmm. We've got a total of about 850 employees, a budget of a little over $90 million a year. We treat somewhere between 14,000 and 16,000 people a year, depending on what's going on that particular year. And we do everything from providing substance abuse care. We have a drug-assisted therapy program that we provide there, a lot of therapy for folks with mental illness situations and substance abuse issues. We do a lot of community development. We have a prevention program that also operates out of the Gemini site that does things like tobacco cessation. It runs support groups for LGBTQ kids. We do a suicide prevention support group. We do a lot of things like that. So FSSA and us are very good partners.
Mm-hmm. Now, if anybody would like more information about the services that the regional health systems can offer, all of the services, and we're not just talking just about the mental health side, but also about the Geminis child care side as well, too, where can they find out more information?
Probably the best thing to do is to check us out on the website, and it's regionalhealthsystems.org. And in there we have tabs that can get you to either Geminis or Regional or our third corporation, which is Lake Park Room Board and Assistance Program.
And by the way, our conversation with Bob Crumweed happened just a few weeks ago, and Regional Health Systems is Northwest Indiana's very own network of care, providing access to comprehensive mental health, primary care, and social services to low-income residents, to underinsured, as well as to uninsured families. This is Regionally Speaking. The 27th annual Letter Carriers Stamp Out Hunger Food Drive is coming up on Saturday, May 11th, and Northwest Indiana post offices are taking part. Merrillville and Gary residents are asked to place their non-perishable food items next to their mailbox to be able to do their part in fighting hunger. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson spoke with Sam Eaton, who is the Merrillville and Gary coordinator for this year's drive, and she got more information to pass along about the drive and also how residents can help.
So tell me about the food drive. Why do the letter carriers do this every year? Because it's been quite a few years, hasn't it?
Actually, we've done this annually for the last 27 years. And basically, just to give you a little history about what we're doing, The letter carrier Stamp Out Hunger Food Drive is an outgrowth of a tradition that the community service exhibited by members of the National Association of Letter Carriers for over the last 125 years. Letter carriers, as we walk through our communities every day, often coming face to face with the community, we do see the sad reality of far too many of our customers that are actually going through hunger situations. So each year, on the second Saturday in May, letter carriers across the country collect non-perishable food donations from our customers. And these donations go directly to our local food pantries to provide to the people in those particular neighborhoods and the surrounding areas with the help to replenish those food pantries or food pantries or food banks. Now, back in 2018, we collected over 71.5 million pounds of food nationally, feeding an estimated 64 million people over the course of our 26-year history. The food drive has collected well over 1.5 billion pounds of food thanks to the Postal Service Universal Delivery Network that spans the entire nation, including Puerto Rico, Guam, and U.S. Virgin Islands.
Have any idea how those numbers break down here in Merrillville, Gary area?
After each collection period, we actually take the food that was collected and we actually weigh the food. And we do have some figures, and I don't want to share those right now because last year the scales were a little off or what have you, but we do actually weigh the food, and sometimes we're in the neighborhood of 40,000 pounds of food collected in some of these areas that are actually going right back into our neighborhood.
And the timing of the food drive being right now is significant because food pantries are usually depleted from Thanksgiving, Christmas, when they get their big donations?
Absolutely, absolutely. And again, the need for the food donations are great because currently 42 million Americans, that's one in six, are unsure where their next meal is coming from. 16 million are children who feel the hunger impact on their overall health and ability to perform in school. And nearly 5 million seniors over the age of 60 are food insecure. So what that means is the food drive is really crucial for us. So with that said, the food banks and pantries often receive the majority of the donations that we do actually collect. And again, like you mentioned, Thanksgiving and Christmas is usually when the intake or when everyone seems to use the food banks, which actually then diminishes and depletes them at that time. So by the springtime, many pantries are depleted when we're actually entering into the spring and summer months, and those pantries are low on supplies, and that's when, you know, school breakfast and lunch programs are not available, you know, for some of the children that are in need. So by us participating with the Letter Carrier Step Out Hunger Food Drive, it just allows us to help in our local communities supply and replenish those food banks during the summer months. And basically what we're doing, we're just asking all the customers on the letter carrier routes throughout our area just to leave a non-perishable food donation in a bag or even in the actual mailbox itself on Saturday, May the 11th, and your letter carrier will do the rest. So with everybody's help and the help of the U.S. Postal Service, we've collected over, again, 1.67 million pounds of food in the United States over the past 26 years as our national food drive has been in place.
Do you usually get a lot of participation here locally?
We do, we do. And actually, what we're doing this year, we want to sort of reintroduce to the community the support as far as getting the schools involved, some of the precinct committee personnel. Not only that, some of the churches, we're sending information out to the churches so they can spread the word to the congregations to, you know, inform them of the dates as well. And we also have volunteers who will actually come out and assist us with their vehicles to help collect food from various donors, you know, maybe that the postal carrier may not be able to, you know, collect that food, you know, within a certain time parameter. So, yes, we have an outpouring of support coming this year. And it's basically because what we're trying to do this year and the years going forward is actually put in place, you know, some partnerships with local participants in the community so we can make this thing go super successful each year going forward.
Okay, so how can people help out? How can people participate?
Well, the biggest help that we can receive from the community is just that everybody kind of spread the word to each other And just remember to mark on their calendars that on Saturday, May the 11th, just please put a non-perishable food item or a bag of food items around their mailboxes or in their mailboxes. And again, our letter carriers, they're out. We're excited. We're really, truly motivated because not only is this a labor of love, we actually are doing, you know, some good in our neighborhoods. And we really take that truly seriously. Not only are we doing that, but letter carriers, we are sort of the eyes and ears of the communities that we actually service. And, you know, we tend to kind of, you know, keep an eye on some of our elderly people. And if we see things that tend to go awry, we're sort of like that first responder type individual that kind of, you know, help get maybe first responders in on situations that are sort of going awry or whatever.
And where does the food go that you guys collect?
That's a great question. Now, this year, we in the Maryville area, we have it situated where Ross Township, they're going to actually help us collect the food and take it to their food bank. And from there, they actually go ahead and pretty much supply and pass out food to other food pantries in the Maryville area. Now, I do believe in the Gary area, there's a food pantry or food bank by the name of Brothers Keeper. So the food that we collect in that area, we're going to actually get it over to the Brothers Keeper. And again, they're going to actually pass food out to some of the other food pantries and churches that actually have food pantries and kitchens in those areas as well.
Okay. Thanks so much, Sam. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate it, Sheriff. And thank you.
Sharon Jackson talking with Sam Eaton. He's the Maryville and Gary coordinator for the Letter Carrier Stamp Out Hunger Food Drive is coming up this weekend. Foster youth in Indiana are less likely than other students to get a quality education, and that's according to the very first ever report about the young people in the state's foster care system. A state law that was enacted in 2018 called for this annual report to be put together and issued. It was presented to the Indiana State Board of Education recently, and Indiana Connected by 25, which is now known as Foster Success, had a chance to get a copy of it. And we had the organization's CEO, Brent Kent, on the program to talk about that report.
It's legislation that actually Indiana Connected by 25 led last session. As you stated earlier, we work with foster youth as they're aging out of care or as if they've already aged out of care. And our goal is to help them transition to adulthood on their own successfully. And we want to make sure that by age 25 that they're thriving, they're housed, they're employed, and they're successful adults. But one of the biggest barriers to their success is the lack of a quality K-12 education. And it's a lot of factors that go into this. Trauma, changing schools. On average, they'll change high schools 3 or 4 times. Their transcripts often don't follow them, so they're taking the same classes over again or out of sequence. But by and large, we have thousands of children in the state's own custody. And before this report, the state had no idea how they were doing in school, even though the state was making many education decisions on their behalf.
From the report that's come out here, you've had a chance to look over the data since it's been out for a few weeks. What have you found and some of the alarming facts that are in the report?
Mm-hmm. Well, we knew the data wouldn't be good, but we weren't prepared for how bad it is. Some of the key highlights is that only 64% of these young people are graduating high school. And about 21% of those graduate with a waiver that's waiving the graduation requirements to let them graduate. Mm-hmm. And what we know from national studies and a study of foster children in the Midwest, that 1 in 5 of these young people will be homeless within 2 years of leaving the state's care. 50% are unemployed at age 24, and only 3% ever obtain a college degree. And when you're looking at this data, it's no wonder. We see that foster children in our K-12 schools are disproportionately suspended and expelled, and there are massive achievement gaps on state assessments. Nowhere is this disparity greater than for Black students in foster care. We already know that foster care has a disproportionate negative effect on Black children and Black families. For example, Black children make up about 10% of the overall child population in Indiana, but about a quarter of the state's child welfare system. And what we see in this report is that our Black children are expelled at nearly 4 times the rate of their peers. And on statewide assessments, they're passing the 10th grade math I-STEP, for example, at a rate of 3.2%. So this report shows us two things. One, children are in foster care are being denied the same educational opportunities as their peers because of their experience in foster care. And two, the state is not doing enough to support their educational and lifetime success.
Are you finding from the data that you got from the report that you mentioned about the achievement that these young people are not necessarily getting because of their situation being in foster care? How do they seem to stand on the ISTEP exams overall?
Mm-hmm. I don't have that data right in front of me, Chris. It is in the report, and it shows just a massive disparity between students in foster care and their peers.
Mm-hmm. I know that you have a number of supporters, of course, not only for Indiana Connected by 25 in the General Assembly, but I guess you have a number of supporters that, as a result, have helped you, I guess, in the effort to get the bill passed last year, last session, to be sure, and probably in turn they're looking at this data and they're showing their concerns as well.
That's right. Chris, we are a very small nonprofit organization. We work all over the state to do the best we can with the little resources we have. We're not an organization with a big budget for advocacy or legislative efforts, so we relied on partnerships with other nonprofits. We relied on former foster youth advocates and our donors to last year come with us to the State House and push this legislation. It was a bit of a David and Goliath story, but this was a necessary first step, getting this data. Without the data, we can't make decisions or a strategic plan around how to improve these outcomes.
Mm-hmm. I also know, too, that your organization is very interested in making sure that there's a tax credit program that will give nonprofits an opportunity to be able to show their support that maybe that hadn't been out there before. Is this right?
That's right. A lot of people don't realize Indiana is ground zero in a national child welfare crisis. Mm-hmm. We've had the highest increase in the number of children entering foster care. We have more children in the state's custody than any surrounding state, even states with two times our population. So what we're asking for is in the state budget, the legislature create a tax credit program. This would benefit nonprofits providing family preservation services and support to foster children so they can quickly respond to this crisis and scale up solutions and hopefully finally put an end to what is now a humanitarian disaster.
Do you know if there's any support right now in this current legislative session, or are you going to have to aim for the 2020 General Assembly session to get the plan together to get the tax credit program up before a vote?
Well, we are optimistic that it can happen this legislative session, mm-hmm. but I think the legislature needs to hear from more of the public. Like I said, we are doing our best, but we are not a legislative lobbying organization. We're a nonprofit providing services directly to youth in the field around the state, but they need to hear from more of the public, but we are optimistic we can make this happen this year.
Indianapolis-based nonprofit Foster Success has that report available on its website. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. Tomorrow on the program, we'll be joined in studio by Indiana State Senator Eddie Melton, and Portage mayoral Democratic candidate Sue Lynch will join us as well. Hope you can, too.